Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets rally on European hopes. China housing prices continue to climb. Geithner is not wanted in Europe. Some notes, commentary on the Bloomberg 50 conference, and Mike Santoli of Barron's, managing editor, will be here as our guest on this edition, number 230 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, howdy. It's another fine day. Well, another great week when it comes to the fun we're having here with investing, isn't it? You having a good time yet? I mean, 5% up in one week, 5% down in another week. I mean, it's getting a little bit tedious. It's fun, but you know what? It's not fun over a long period of time. It adds a little bit of excitement. It adds a little bit of distraction from the mundane little bits up, little bit down that you may see over years of time when markets are stagnating. But this is getting a little ridiculous. The movement to, extremes on a regular basis. But we'll get to that. This is Andrew Horowitz, as I mentioned, and we have a great show that is lined up for you today. A few things I want to talk about first and remind you of, but we got Mike Santoli, who's going to be with us. And Mike and I go back 3, 4, 5 years, been talking on and off for some time, and he is a great person to get information about what is really happening on the street and with in the mind of advisors, because he's getting all sorts of information on a constant basis, doing a lot of interviewing for Barron's, and it's a fine newspaper, and I think that they do a great job at really dissecting a lot of the things that have a really good interest when it comes to the investment community. But I want to tell you a couple of things, and we'll get into some of these stories and some things that I want to focus in on, but I want to mention that we got an overwhelming amount of requests already for Stocktoberfest, which is starting in about 2 weeks from now. But what I want you to do is, instead of sending anything directly to me, because it kind of got a little bit crazy with all the emails, we're going to put a little quick form. You just put your name and information and the stock that you want us to look at. Because Stocktoberfest, each and every day, we're putting up requests that you have, and we're going to run it through our process of ranking, rating, and coming up with an actual recommendation of what we see from a technical and fundamental basis on the stock that you have. Couple of rules: you can't really do anything with penny stocks, stocks that are terribly new, or things that maybe don't trade very much. So please try to keep those stocks at those reasonable ones. Doesn't have to be Microsoft or Deere or JCPenney, something that everybody knows. But you could be reasonable. You know, if there's a stock that is a penny stock and it's been that way for the last 5 years with no fundamentals, no earnings, first of all, it's not going to get rated very high, and second of all, we're probably not going to have the ability to do much with it. Just the way it goes. So send that to us. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put a link in every podcast show notes. There'll be a little form there and a link to the Stocktoberfest festivities. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll mention your name. We're going to talk about it on the podcast as well throughout the month of October. And we'll also put your name on the blog and talk about that, unless you tell us specifically not to, of course. But we will have a little form that is put on the show notes. And you can just put the information in and we'll automatically send it off. This way we can manage the amount that's coming in, because we're probably going to have, some days we may have more than two, more than one, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And you'll be able to see why the stock is maybe doing really well on our scoring system, or maybe where it missed. We have that all outlined for you as well, and to give you a down and dirty analysis from a fundamental and technical score as we see it. Okay, so when it comes to things like, price earnings ratio, or maybe things like buybacks, those are not the biggest consideration when we look at a stock. There's a lot of other things that can really propel a stock over the long haul and a fundamental basis. And then also, of course, is it breaking down on a technical basis? So make sure that you do that. Just pile that in. The other thing I'll mention to you is that, of course, all throughout the month of September, What we're doing is we are putting all of the posts that we write to our clients on our private client blog, because a lot of people ask for this. You know, what exactly is it that you talk about on a regular basis to your clients of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy? And I said, well, it was kind of, do we put it online? Don't we? So we're just going to do this in September, maybe sometime way in the future. It's going to be a while, though. Throughout September, every day that we write an information piece to our clients, we're going to actually let that be available on the Disciplined Investor as well. So make sure that you log in, follow me on Twitter at Andrew Horowitz. This way you'll get a instant Twitter tweet when the post is put up, and you can follow along what we're writing to our clients every day. What we do is we write every day on a summary page. So every week we start a brand new blog summary page, this private client blog, and we write on a daily basis throughout the day, sometimes only once per day, but we write about the stocks that we have, the economics. We put a lot of things that you don't see that we put on the public site for our clients, talking about maybe some of the specifics behind a rally, or maybe some of the volume issues, or maybe a variety of different oscillators from a technical basis. We don't get into every single nook and cranny about a stock that we have all the time, because we don't necessarily are looking for a way to kind of explain every single thing, but just to talk about what it is that is going on and keep us in contact and closer understanding for our clients about what it is that we're doing. So there's no confusion, and there's a lot more, I guess, closeness with what is happening versus, not knowing, like when you're in a mutual fund. Speaking of which, there was record outflows of mutual funds over the last, since April. More outflows from mutual funds, about $75 billion from equity mutual funds, than was post-Lehman. And that's quite amazing, where there is a dramatic mass exodus, really, from equity mutual funds that we're seeing. And you can see that is damaging the potential for a rally in one way, because there's a lot of hesitancy for people to keep their money in right now with all they see going on, which we'll talk about in a second. And then what happened is that obviously without that money, there's no ability really for the bullish sentiment to be held up too high. So, what's happening right now is, while we saw that big swing last week on a short covering rally into options expiration, which was exacerbated by the dollar swaps that were put into place by the U.S. and a few other countries for Europe, there was excitement over the fact that there'll be some greater liquidity for the banks. By the way, that lasted one day when it came to the European banks. Realize something. The reason that this was done, and just to back up, what was done was that there was the best way to describe it is that there was a liquidity crunch, because no one was no longer really willing to provide any kind of funding for the European banks and other institutions throughout Europe. So what happened was, you saw, for example, many of the mutual funds that utilize European banks for overnight or short-term CD lending. They would send money over there, and maybe if they needed redemptions, they would retrieve it through a wire, and it would go back and forth, and sometimes they'd even buy their CDs. Well, all of a sudden, a lot of municipalities and mutual funds had said, you know what? We're not doing this. We don't want to risk breaking the buck in any of our mutual fund money markets, because all of a sudden, there is something that happens very severe, and a lockdown in Europe and a catastrophe. It's just not worth it. Well, this kind of grew with the realization that there was a lot of really bad debt from Italy and Portugal and Greece on the books of these banks, particularly the French banks, some in Germany, good amount in Germany, but more in France. All of a sudden, there was this liquidity squeeze, just like what happened with Lehman. Lehman basically collapsed, not only because it had all of this bad, toxic debt on its books, but because nobody would really do business with them anymore, with the fear that they wouldn't get their money back, even on a short-term basis. So what do you do in that situation when you rely on this? Well, what you do is you go out and you figure out somewhere where you can get money from, and it was the ECB. They were injecting money, their overnight lending. And all of a sudden, that really was going to be a problem. So there was a coordinated effort that dollars would be lent, if you will, or traded at a guaranteed amount. So the swap agreement, so that there could be liquidity for the banks to trade back and forth with a backstop, that there wouldn't be the worry that you'd be stuck out there. It's not really a bailout more than it was a, I guess, an administrative slash, I guess, a greasing of the wheels to keep the process of lending going so there wasn't that fear that all of a sudden it would seize up. That lasted one day. The reality is not that there's only a liquidity problem, but the fact is that there's a liquidity problem due to a structural underlying problem with the debt and the realization that Greece, and I'll just say it, is not going to pay back their debts. Or at least they're going to, they're going to have a selective bankruptcy very soon. Greece already has asked for an advance, so an acceleration of the next tranche of money from the IMF and ECB, because they're not going to make the next date. They're talking about increasing taxes. They're trying to double it again. But you know what? This is all talk. And Greece has everyone by the cojones, and they know it. Because no one wants Greece to fail. Greece leaving the European Union would be a disaster. Disaster. Can you imagine waking up one morning and somebody saying, you know, just to let you know, no longer can you use any of the monies that you have in your banks. We'll exchange it for you, but it's going to take a while, and the credit cards you have are all canceled, and you know it's just going to take some time to get everything back online, and your businesses are going to have all sorts of problems because nobody's going to lend to you and until you get this all straightened out. And I mean, what do you do? Well, Greece moving out of the EU would cause, obviously, massive problems for Greece, but also the inability for banks to lend because there's such fear about them collapsing under the weight of the Greek bonds with haircuts. And then on top of that, the dysfunction that would happen within the EU and the continuing toppling factor of, you know, the other countries like Italy and Portugal. My biggest concern is France. Now, I had some discussion with the managing director of Global Sovereign Ratings, John Chambers, up in New York when I was at the Bloomberg 50 conference. And I talked to him about, I told him congratulations for downgrading the U.S. I think that was a great move. It really saved us a lot of money. And I think it was the right move because it was the right move. But, you know, I said, what about countries like France and Spain? And why aren't they being downgraded? And I said, the problem you have is, my understanding is that, you know, is it that because if you do so, the domino effect of the problems you'll have by losing the AAA status of the ESFS, which is that fund that all the countries are putting money into, is that going to be a problem? What's going on? I'll give you the punchline first. And he said that, you know, everything is under review. And he said it in a way that, I don't know. I got the impression that obviously they're very much on the view of and on the story of France, looking at the incidentals and seemingly not too much concern about, you know, anything more than sticking by what they do, which is raiding the country. And but he did say that the problem would be that France would still be able to provide, but there would be a lot heavier weight put on Germany. And Germany's getting just plainly pissed off. You know, right now we saw another major loss, the Pirates. And this is not the baseball team. It's the the parties in Germany. And this is, I think, the fifth or maybe the sixth that there was no confidence vote, essentially, for Angela Merkel. And what that means is that they're tired of having the deep pockets. Germany's pissed, you know, because they know that with Greece being able to say whatever they want about pretend tax and austerity measures, that at the end of the day, that they're going to be forced to provide the money unless they want to just end this whole charade now. They have two choices. They let this whole thing go on and basically bankrupt themselves, or maybe it just, you know, somehow works out. Or what they do is they go out and they say, I'm not doing this anymore. And they pretty much bankrupt themselves now. It would seem that doing it earlier than later would be a better way to do things and probably would be a very painful event for the world. But you know what? You shouldn't have let them in the first place. It was very clear that there were some underlying problems with Greece and Italy and Portugal prior to bringing them into the European Union. And I don't know why any other country would want to come in right now. Seems like you'd just be throwing more, you know, good money after bad. So right now, here we are. We're in the situation where Germany is very much opposed to their current leadership and what they're doing with their finances. The consumer confidence is pretty much falling off a cliff in Germany. And on top of that, Geithner goes over, Timothy Geithner, our own head kneecapper of the U.S., you know, wherever he goes, he seems to, I don't know, he must say something to people, you know, like, you know, I'm going to, listen, here's the deal. I may look like a nice guy and it kind of, you know, I part my hair like I'm a, you know, a businessman from Wall Street in Washington, but let me tell you something, buddy. Joe Pesci taught me how to play. I mean, seriously, he goes into places like China and he goes into Europe and other countries, and they come out and they do things that you never thought they'd do in a million years. I mean, he went to China and he persuaded them somehow with this silly letter in his breast pocket of his suit to start aggressively revaluing their currency. I mean, what possibly did he say? And he goes over to meet with, I think it was 12 ministers, financial ministers of the countries in Europe in a special meeting in Warsaw, Poland. Maybe it was Krakow. Anyway, I think it was in Poland. I know it was in Poland. And he starts providing some information. Well, he says, I think what you should do is really come up with a much bigger amount of money from the ESFS, that emergency fund they put together. You know, maybe 200 or 300% of what you're doing now, like maybe $2 or $3 trillion, and overwhelm the situation and really do something like we did with our TALF program and, you know, backstop this whole thing and really, you know, the banks make sure they're okay and blah, 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 blah. And basically they said, Mr. Geithner, thank you very much for coming. We asked you as a listen-only guest, and the information that you're providing is very nice, but you know what? We are not inclined to take your advice when, frankly, you're the one whose country caused this mess to begin with. And on top of that, we see how you're managing your finances, and frankly, we're not interested. We will not, we have not, and won't be the bailout of banks like you have been. And we do not believe in that. And that was from two top German officials, the two top officials of Germany's finance ministry, as well as several other players said, you know what, we're really not interested in hearing what the United States has to say. Hmm. Basically, Mr. Geithner, shut the up. So now here we are. Geithner goes home. George Papadopoulos, whatever his name is. I apologize for that, but I can't say his name. I just can't do it. The Greek prime minister was planning a trip to make a couple of speeches here in New York and I believe Washington. Cancels it at the last minute. Saying that he has a lot more pressing items that he needs to deal with at home during the next week, which is going to be a critical time for Greece. And it's no time to be making speeches around the world. It's going to take off a whole week, actually, which I think it's probably a good idea that he's, you know, on the microphone over there in Europe in his hometown versus being in the United States right now. But boy, that's kind of an interesting development, I thought. Last minute, meeting with the president and Geithner again, and we got this tied up with how Europe basically thrown us out of their European meeting. And then you have a discussion of the lack of willingness to really increase the ESFS. And, you know, I think what you're going to see now is a significant, unless there's some other bizarre situation that happens, there'll be some very significant potential for weakness in the euro coming up very shortly. Now, that euro, I'll tell you something, there's been a very interesting trade. The metals have been trading somewhat opposite of what you usually see. Gold has been moving all around the place, but I'll tell you, it's been more tied to the euro than anything else. So usually when you see the euro starting to move up, dollar moves down, you know, gold is also moving up, but now you almost have the opposite, although gold can go either way. Silver, we are short of silver. Not a big position, but we're short of silver. We think that silver, if it does bust down below its 50-day again, which is high 39s, which is about less than about 80 cents away, less than 2% away. It broke down last week, popped right back up through options expiration, and we do think that there's a potential for this to really break down, because what we saw was when the sell-offs occurred over the last few weeks, silver really was starting to get aggressively sold. And one of the reasons may be is simply from the aspect of the need to liquidate part of your portfolio to pay for your margin on the other side. Now, there's a lot of bets on the short side right now. As a matter of fact, we saw the short selling numbers come out. They're about a week and a half old, but it's the best you can do. There has been a dramatic increase on short bets. Well, just in time for a little market rally, I thought. It's kind of interesting. We'll see the next one out in about 3 or 4 days from now. Something like that, maybe. About 3 or 4 days from now. We'll try to post that on the website as well. By the way, make sure to follow the website. I'm just telling you, we put up a lot of good information for you to keep track of. Or just, I mentioned this before, and I got to do a better job at this. Make sure to follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Because every time we put a post up, it hits you on Twitter, and you'll know what to grab and where to go and what to read. So just go to Andrew Horowitz and follow that along. At Andrew Horowitz, I guess you say. So in the end of this, we are also short European shares. We actually were short, made a beautiful profit on it a few weeks ago, sold it down right before the gigantic rally to about 1%, and then built it up over the last week to it's about a 5% portfolio position, and we double that with a two-time inverse ETF. The symbol is E, P as in Peter, V as in Victor, Edward Peter Victor. And this is a two-time inverse ETF. Now, the reason we like this, a couple of different ways to play the same game, but the reason we like this is because you really get a double multiplier effect with not only European shares, but you also get it with the euro. Because when you, by the way, if you didn't know this, when you buy an ETF, let's say you buy an ETF of Brazil, are you aware that you will not only get the performance of the Brazilian market, let's say, but you'll also get the comparative performance of how the Brazilian currency does to the U.S. currency? You have to look at this. So in other words, if there was no movement in the underlying index in any given day, and let's say the U.S. dollar moves up by 1% and the Brazilian currency moves down by 1%, you will lose 1%. So what we have here with the EPV is technically a short on the euro and a short on European shares. That's why we like it. Now, you have to watch this because there's a 2x leverage, and you really want to start only buying this when there's a trend possibly developing, because if you get that choppy movement, it really starts to degrade the performance over time. So look at that as an idea. We like that. And again, we put that on the daily notes for our clients that we're going to put on the website. Now, I wanted to also talk about some news, and I want to talk about the Bloomberg 50 conference. But before I do, I want to just pay for the show, as they say. You know, this show is brought to you by GoToMeeting, and meetings are, I don't know about you, but for me, they're an essential part of, you know, my business day. We don't have meetings every single day, but when you do, I tell you, to get up and travel wherever you're going to go, it's so much better just to do everything, if you can, from your office and share your screen, share a meeting, go on and have an interactive conversation with your client, with a potential client, with a family member, with, you can do it for school for your kids. It's so many different ways that you can actually use this kind of screen sharing technology. And it may, you know, you may have heard about this before. If you haven't tried it out, it's very cool how it works. Because basically you just sign in and the other party signs in, and then you're just in a meeting with questions and answers and polls and things like somebody raises their hand, and you have all these people that are in a room. You know, when I give a presentation sometimes, there's, you know, 100, 150 people, and you look at what's going on, and you have the ability to work with several different moderators or people online, voice over IP. There's all sorts of different things you can do, all different levels. But basically, very easy if you want to make it that way as well, because you just log on and maybe upload a PowerPoint presentation, or maybe just show what's on your desktop, or run a program real time with somebody. What you could do is check it out for 30 days for free. This is what's great about it. GoToMeeting is free for my listeners. All you have to do is go to gotomeeting.com and then click on the try it free button and enter the promo code podcast. Very simple. Gotomeeting.com, enter the promo code podcast. You get 30 days of free, unlimited, fully blown software from GoToMeeting. Check it out. All right, where were we? We were talking about, oh, yes. Quickly, we're going to talk about China's housing situation. You know, China's housing prices in Beijing, and as a matter of fact, all 70 cities, rose again on a year-over-year basis. And this is defying all of the potential You know, all the things that are going on there for them to tighten down on the lending and on the expansive and massive growth that's going on. They've raised the rates. They've let the yuan drive higher. They've actually increased reserves. There's just a ton of things, and yet we're seeing a 1.9% year-over-year gain in Beijing, 2% and change in Shanghai on a year-over-year basis. Not as bad as it was when we saw about a year and a half ago, about 6% increases on a year-over-year basis. But still, the pricing is so high that these kind of moves are still problematic and exacerbate the situation and probably cause their government to pull their hair out a little bit because they're doing everything they can to slow this down. It's a train that's not going to slow down. We got some really good letters in last week because I talked with, who did I talk with about this? I think it was Frank Herzio, a couple of weeks back, about the whole idea of, you know, what's going on in China, the housing situation, and Jim Chanos. We talked about this, and some good letters came in about how, you know, there really isn't as much as an outwardly, I guess the outward look on what's going on is very cheery. As a matter of fact, I spent some time with Stephen Roach from Morgan Stanley, and we talked about, he's a guy that, by the way, if you ever meet him and talk with him, he knows everything. And by the way, he'll tell you that. I mean, basically, whatever you say, no matter what you say, he kind of is a big guy in disagreement. And he's a smart fella, brilliant fella, no question about that. The guy who many years ago came up with the whole idea of globalization, I believe, and whole really has been just gangbuster bullish on China for years, or that whole region, Asia. And talked about, I asked him, you know, when I was in China, I talked about, you know, the whole idea that this massive inflation going on from a food and just a everyday living standard type of aspect. And he basically told me, that's great, but you can't just judge what somebody says on the street. I said, well, okay. Doesn't your data show you the same thing? He said, yeah. So, all right. And there was this discussion between him and, I believe it was Carson Block, who from Muddy Waters, he talked about how there was just this really murky type of, I guess the out exterior looked really nice, but the interior was really questionable. A lot of bad financial transactions going on, and he rattled off. Now, he's a short, not in stature, but in financial sightings in terms of long versus short. And so he sees that side of things, and that's very interesting because when you get two people in the room and they have these opposite and really polar opposite opinions, it's very interesting to watch. And I watched three people on the stage talk about the same topic, and in the end, they kind of all said the same thing. I mean, that there was this great thing going on there, but the question was, how long does it last? And because the economics are provided by the government, you know, who really may not have a great handle on such a vast amount of land space and such an incredible population, that we don't know if we could really trust all those numbers. It is amazing to me. I got to tell you something, folks. Listen to this. Have you seen the amount of not only revisions, but the amount of discrepancy between estimates and actual lately here in the United States? I mean, big numbers, big differences. And we've been doing this a long time, and we've been tracking these numbers for a long time. But yet, when you look at the numbers from China, they're almost always right on the estimates. I find that fascinating. I mean, you have a country that is far bigger, far more populated in terms of just, you know, what goes on there. Yeah, business is different and the economy is different, of course, but we're much more spread out in terms of, you know, all over the place and farms and places that you can't really measure. And yet they're coming so close to their economic estimates. I mean, wow, pretty impressive, I guess. So what we have now is a situation in China that they're trying to rein things in. In Brazil, they just unexpectedly released and dropped their rate. India just increased and their rate again over the weekend. You have massive problems in the banking area throughout the world. You're also getting some leakage now in Korea. They shut down about 7 or 8 institutions over the weekend, and their markets have been up 3%, down 4%, up 5%, down 2%. I mean, South Korea is out of control, the KOSPI. But the thing that I will tell you that I got out of the Bloomberg 50. And by the way, all of my notes will be on thedisciplinedinvestor.com this week. Put a very long discussion. So if you want to, you know, find out what I was listening to and from the likes of Wilbur Ross and Carson Block and the head of the S&P rating service for sovereign wealth and who else was there? Ray Dalio and just some real serious fellas there. But the one thing that really took away and I thought was really fascinating was when there was a conversation about the next great hedge fund idea. And there was three different people on the panel and they were talking about how things have changed over the last several years. And in particular, there was a woman who was the head of a algorithmic high-frequency trading type of firm who had a number of years ago, well, maybe about 4 years ago, about 35 employees made up primarily of mathematicians and computer programmers and some engineers and things of that nature. Now, I don't know if you can pick this up, but I didn't say fundamental analysts. I didn't say stock pickers. I didn't say technical analysts. I said programmers, statisticians, mathematicians. Now that she has over 85 people working for her, and basically she said this, that over the last couple of years, the speed of the movements has been accelerating at an incredible pace. So much so that they have had to continually readjust their system to keep up with it. Now, I'm not talking about the pace of actual trading. I'm talking about the pace of movement from, yeah, we're happy, let's go long. No, we're not happy, let's go short. Big moves up, big moves down. And what I was thinking at that moment was, wow, if she's talking about this with respect to how fast things are moving, and one of the things that we do know is that high-frequency trading supposedly has about 70 to 80% of the daily volume in the exchanges. Okay, even if it's only 50, it's still a lot. If she has to go and recalibrate and move faster to get ahead of the next guy is going to go ahead and recalibrate and get faster than her and her firm. And this cycle is just going to continue on and on. And as it does, it's going to create an extreme level of stress on the markets. So we get, for example, a day like we had with the flash crash happening much more regularly. Now, I believe that the recent drop that we saw was kind of a slow motion flash crash where there was a slower process of pulling bids and the machines kind of shutting down a little bit and cooling off. But it really struck me that they had to get faster and in front of the next guy. And what does that mean to the average investor? Because no longer do we have this world of, I guess, investing based on fundamentals and technicals as the core of our markets. Sometimes, and over time, that will show up. But right now, it appears that there is this overwhelming amount of just playing a directional bet on the exchange movement. Interesting. You know, I think it's a good time because I want to pick this conversation up with Mike Santoli. So let's get him lined up. All right, we're with the rather interesting, famous, and front page kind of guy, Mike Santoli. Writes a lot for one of the front page columns for Barron's, of course, and he is writing all the time on a variety of trading ideas. And we haven't had him on for a while. So, hey, Mike, what's going on there in Barron's world?
Pretty much the usual. Just trying to make sense of these markets with limited success, which I think is the way it is for most of us.
You know, I had a great. I told you I was at the Bloomberg conference a couple of days back, and one of the panels was something about the new and greatest potential hedge fund to come. In other words, what's going to be the next great idea? And one of the things was a high frequency trader that had 35 employees a couple of years ago, mathematicians and engineers. And now they have 85. And I think the key here is that they have mathematicians and engineers and computer programmers, not fundamental analysts or technical analysts or anything like that. So really what they're doing is they are creating a much different game. And on top of that, they're complaining that the game keeps on getting faster and faster and faster. So they need to speed up their systems. Then the next guy has to do it. I mean, what's your take on that?
Absolutely. It's been an arms race. I always think about the old Mad Magazine cartoon Spy versus Spy. Mm-hmm. It's every player that is looking for just the merest edge possible through the technology and through speed. It's almost like better to be fast than smart. Now you have to be smart to get that much faster. And I do think it has changed the rhythms of the market to some degree. I don't think it's responsible for big moves up or down on any enduring way, but it definitely, during the day, these guys are basically throwing orders at the market at an absurd pace and trying to have it collide with, you know, real order flow from you and me and from big mutual funds and such, and try to decipher what the real order flow might say about the order that comes behind it, right? And I think about it in a couple of ways. One is somebody in the market, some group in the market has always been of the highest frequency traders, mm-hmm. whether the frequency was a minute, 30 seconds, a second, or now microseconds. And so therefore there was always somebody who was essentially looking to read the tape and just get in the way of a little spread in between, which mostly I think is what these folks are doing. But what the problem I think you might come to when it becomes such a dominant part of the market, and people keep talking about 70% of volume might be represented by high-frequency folks. And by the way, I think that means high-frequency guys are at least on one side mm-hmm. of 70% of all trades, let's say, is that they don't really provide information content about prices, right? They're just trying to interact with the order flow. They don't have a thesis, as you say, on the fundamentals or even on the technicals for the most part. It's mostly about just algorithms that look at probabilities and try to read intentions of others. And so I think if you have too much of the market where the order flow is not giving new information or important information about businesses and all the rest that we think the stock market's supposed to do, then it becomes a little bit less reliable. And of course, you've also had this related phenomenon of exchange-traded funds on an intraday basis becoming such a dominant force. Therefore, the market, if it's up, it's almost everything's up. If it's down, almost everything's down. And only over time do you have individual stocks that get credit or blame based on true fundamentals.
Right. As a matter of fact, the correlation index that looks at the correlation of individual stocks to the overall markets hit a high, I think, about 4 days ago.
That's right.
A historical high, by the way. Which is pretty interesting. And it's everything is, you know, they say, well, everything is involved with Europe and everything's involved in every news item. It is pretty spooky how news items, the slightest news item, can move a tape so dramatically in such a short period of time.
It is. And, you know, it's really a reflection of the obsessive focus on these mega macro issues, right? It's you know, sure, RIM, you know, disappoints on earnings, it'll go down 20% because of what's going on at RIM, but that's the outlier. For the most part, when you don't have real dramatic corporate news, or even domestic economic news, it is about, you know, I think the market moved a lot the other day on, you know, the Austrian,
right.
you know, finance minister says something, and all of a sudden we have to read into that, and the market just doesn't wait to decipher it. They just sort of, you know, they buy or they sell. So it's definitely, and it's funny because I think in this context, stocks are kind of the tail and not the dog. They're kind of the residual asset class that moves. It's kind of the currencies. It's the government bonds. It's the, you know, credit default swaps. It's the corporate debt. And then, you know, equities figure out what they have to do. But it's all moving in the same direction, as you said.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that you have this algorithmic and high-frequency trader that's kind of going out there and trying to test the market, see where things are, press on a little bit over here and see what happens, and then read from that what it means, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that governments are doing the same thing. You know, how many times mm-hmm. have we seen an announcement come out that says something like, I think it was the Dutch government, I think, last week, they said something about, well, we think that Greece would be best to default and move out of the euro, or something of that nature,
right.
Something like that. And then you saw the markets get all pissy and upset and all that, and then next thing you know, we never said that. You know, that's not what we meant. Like, what?
That's true.
Yeah, Geithner was going over. There was one announcement. Geithner was going over, and he said there should be a much larger, he's gonna opt for a much larger ESFS, the Stability Fund for Europe. And I call him the kneecapper, by the way. That's our nickname for him. You know, when he goes, all of a sudden, something always seems to happen dramatic. It's like, what is he exactly saying when he walks in that room, you know?
Right.
But then all of a sudden, there was a rumor that he wasn't going to do so. And then on the other side, now he's looking for private funds. So it's kind of like this constant I don't know what you'd call it, fishing expedition, right?
It's trial and error. It's you can almost envision that before you get any of these announcements, the final word in the meeting was, well, maybe that'll work. And you know, I do also think a lot of these sort of testing or half measures are a reflection of the fact that, you know, you have genuinely divided, you know, philosophical approaches here. It's, I mean, some people are wanting to be the hard leg of Scandinavia and seem to just want to be hard line in terms of Greece. You know, we want better collateral and more collateral, and the other countries are like, let's just, you know, let's try to paper this over with more liquidity. But you're right, and I think that's why I think the investors have been during this last 4 weeks or whatever it's been kind of awaiting what they anticipate will be kind of Europe's TARP moment, where the markets throw enough of a tantrum that it finally gets the attention of the politicians and regulators to say, okay, fine, we have to go and become proactive as opposed to just, you know, trying to chase this crisis down the hole. Not saying it's going to happen that way, but I think that's the orientation of investors right now. And I think it's an uncomfortable place for a lot of traditional investors to be because, you know, when things seem to hinge on official government action, central bank action, something like that, it's just completely, you know, impossible to handicap. And it has nothing to do with what you normally do, which is try to evaluate asset classes on their merits.
Right. Let's switch gears for a second. I want to talk. You talk to a lot of advisors and institutionals. You read a lot of research and all that. All of a sudden, a couple of days ago, we get either, you want to call it a capitulation, you got an aha moment, you get a fed up and throw in the towel. I don't know what you call it. But we get brand new numbers from Goldman, J.P. Morgan, and Citi that now the end of year is going to be anywhere between 1150 to 1250, depending on the player, right? And
right.
And this is down from about, I think everybody had about 1400-ish on their numbers for the end of the year because they did their simple, very basic
right. Napkin
P.E. ratio times earnings is this.
Right.
So what happened? How come all of a sudden everybody throws in the towel?
You know, people essentially do very little more than filter, you know, the last couple of months' GDP numbers and ISM numbers through their models, and that's one thing, right? And so that's going to at least, you know, dampen the earnings estimate, and then the math changes in terms of what the multiple is. But the other thing that goes on is, it's obvious, it's human nature. Strategists kind of chase what's just happened, and you know, all of a sudden you feel silly when the market's threatening to go down below 1100 and you're sitting there with a 1400 target, you know. I'm not of the mind that, you know, strategists in aggregate are kind of always wrong. In fact, last year they kind of nailed it, mm-hmm. by luck or by skill, but it definitely happens that you want to see expectations moderate if you're bullish. You want to see people not think everything's going to be great. And so I don't personally think that we got any kind of climactic sentiment purge recently, but you got pretty close in some respects. And at least I think the market has bought itself a little bit of space and time by bouncing a little bit here. But right now, to me, it's mostly just a bounce.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, most people are talking about, that's the other thing. All of a sudden, everybody's talking about this is a bounce and that, you know, this is a kind of a, you know, a point of time that we have all this liquidity that was just put in. But then the question is, well, why was the liquidity put into the European banks? Is they setting up for a Greece or a default? I mean, what's going on there? You know, but first is to, of course, get all excited about it. The one thing I wanted to ask you about CDS, credit default swaps.
Mm-hmm.
What's the point of these anymore if nobody ever seems to fail?
I mean,
you know, if I think that if I was a government, I'd be the seller of these things. What a great deal. Mm-hmm. Think about it. You sell these all day long, and you hold the marionette strings of who can default and not, so you basically just collect money all day long.
Yeah, well, it's true. and to be honest with you, I've been wondering precisely who is the seller right now. I mean, I know generally who is the seller. It's hedge funds, it's some insurance companies, it's some brokers and all the rest. But, you know, in a post-AIG world, because AIG ended up being the seller of all this junk back in 08. In a post-AIG world, Fortis is gone. You know, all these big capital pools are gone. And to me, what it means is that the seller almost I think the pricing probably advantages the seller, as you kind of suggest. Mm-hmm. It's a little inefficient. And, you know, the funny thing is, too, there's all this talk about, well, what's going to qualify, let's say you own Greece credit default swaps, what's going to qualify as a default for CDS purposes? If they've lengthened the maturities, if they get a restructuring, what's going to happen here? Now, it can cause mischief on both sides. If let's say, lengthening the maturities or taking a haircut does qualify as a default, then obviously, you know, if you have to pay. But if it doesn't qualify as a default, well, here's the thing: you can make a case. You could buy the bond right now at these crazy interest rates, sell, buy the credit default swaps, and still you're in the money.
Yeah.
And then still lose. But if they lengthen the maturities, let's say, and if the authorities say that's not a default for CDS purposes, you know, you can still go to your counterparty and say, you know, screw you, pay me. I mean, it's very murky. Nobody really knows, you know, exactly how these things are going to operate under stress. I honestly think it's also a relatively thin market. We put so much weight on it.
Yeah, I agree.
But there you go.
And I'll tell you something, though, that it is interesting that when we went through the whole last round of Greece potentially restructuring and clearly doing something for maybe some markdowns and then requiring maybe certain participation and rollouts, how it didn't qualify for a default is really unbelievable. You would think that the next generation of CDS will be written with some kind of other, you know, more clearer risk factors in there. But
sure.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I spent some time yesterday or the day before with Gary Gensler, and I asked a variety of questions. I must tell you, I was a little bit I was shocked with some of the comments that he made. First of all, that, you know, the rules and regs that he was doing for the whole market of you know, under his jurisdiction, you know, he was supposed to have all this stuff done already, or his departments, and they're months late. And so somebody asked him, "Well, was there any penalty for you being late on this?" Well, no, you know, no.
Right.
We're just you know, doing our thing and going to get it done in good time. And you know, you have to wonder what is taking so long. One of the things is he's accepting outside information in terms of ideas or at least commentary. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, this whole thing is it does make you wonder of. If the whole game is to not trigger a credit default swap, because then if it does, who knows who is going to have to bail out who again?
Right.
You know, what they're going to do. Mystery trader. Tell me a little bit about why we should pay so much attention to this, because it sounds a little, for you, I'll be honest with you. You know, you're a straight up guy.
Yeah.
It seems
kind
of weird that you would be writing about that.
Well, it is a little weird, and I'm very conscious of trying not to oversell or kind of overuse this particular guy, and I have to stress that he's just, I've said this in print, he's just a broker. I don't mean him to kind of be a cover for some wildly well-known guru out there at all. He just happens to be a guy who I've been in touch with through his client letters and such for a number of years, and he's just sort of been uncommonly in tune with what's about to happen. And, you know, as I said, when I first used him, it hasn't been the case yet that maybe by giving him some ink, I'm top-ticking his genius, you know, and all of a sudden his hand's going to go cold. But no, he's just somebody who's thoughtful and who integrates a lot of different approaches, right? It's obviously it's fundamental. It's a little bit of macro. It's a little bit of technical, and it's a little bit of just market history and cycles that he likes to play with. Not very, not highly specific or technical ones, you know. Not one of these rigid systems,
right?
But just the general idea and sentiment, which I always look at a lot. So he's been kind of on it now without being obviously perfect. He's kind of kept his clients on the right side of things. You know, my first email exchanges with him in not too long after the bottom in March, right? Mm-hmm. We had this furious rebound rally, obviously, almost vertical from March of 2009. And it was very common to say, this is a bear market rally, and this doesn't go anywhere from here. And, you know, he was making the opposite case. And I said to him, why? You know, and he said, his simple answer in his email was, because the financial crisis is over.
Hmm.
Who else was saying that in, let's say, April of 2009? And I'm not saying, you know, he wasn't just lucky. So this is why. And again, I was really flabbergasted by the kind of response it initially got me. People basically sending me, you know, how can I open an account with him? He refuses to do that. The other thing I like about it, and this is weird, and I certainly am always happy to attribute specifically any ideas that I get and I use. But the fact that he doesn't want to be identified is strictly because his firm doesn't wish him to be a spokesman for the firm. It's
right,
not because
right.
he's got any firm. But, you know, he's not doing it because he self-aggrandizing motives. It's just because he likes to talk markets.
Yeah, and that's good also because, in a way, you say that you're not going to top tick him, but, you know, you really can't because if it's not... His stuff isn't out there, and you're not attributed to him. It's not like all these people are buying his stuff, and he's changing his direction. Because
that's true.
He doesn't know when you're going to use him or not.
He now has no idea. Right.
So, you know,
exactly.
You may... All right. Sentiment. Last thing I want to talk to you about. Sentiment has been, bad. Let's just say that. And I've looked at corporate CEO sentiment. I've looked at, obviously, UMich and you know, just across the board. Okay, let's just say across the board. This Obama... tax plan, which looks to me, I shouldn't say tax plan. I think there's a slip.
It's a little slip.
I didn't mean that. I meant to say the Obama jobs plan. It looks like a left pocket to right pocket kind of thing to me. You know, you take a little bit from over here, a little bit from over here, a little bit from there. By the way, $4 billion hidden surcharge on wireless that hasn't been really discussed that much. A lot of cutbacks in Medicaid. And then it goes over to the other side. So I'm not sure where that happens to be stimulating, by the way. And about from $250,000 to $400,000 per job created is the current estimate. Sentiment is down on this. Republicans about to say throw this whole thing out. President Obama's overall sentiment is the lowest it's been in a long time. Consumer sentiment, market sentiment is pretty down. Europe, Japan, blah-de-de-blah-de-blah. Just take it out. Just keep on moving it out. Where do we go from here? I mean, is this a big sentiment game right now?
To some degree it is, and I think, you know, if it depends on, you have to slice it. The consumer side, it seems to me, just, you know, despondent and almost immune to potential good news at this point. And that's understandable, right? I mean, most people haven't experienced this kind of sort of stubbornly sluggish supposed recovery before, after such a deep downturn. So that side of it, I don't really, first of all, I don't see that much of a driver of the market. More modestly a driver of you know, retail activity, but that isn't even a very good relationship. So it's much more about, you know, people are ticked off. And what it does seem to mean is that there's a big challenge for the president to get reelected, because that's kind of how it directly filters in, right?
Right.
Market sentiment, I don't think is... I think market sentiment is just exactly as negative as one should expect it to be, given what's happened in the market.
Yeah, I'm right.
Given
the
how rapidly the market's gone down, how tough the headlines have been, and all the rest of it. So I don't see it as a leading indicator that things are going to get worse, but I also don't see it as like the clearest possible contrary indicator, because we're still going to have to deal with, you know, corporate earnings estimates going to get revised down and all the rest of it. In terms of the jobs plan, you're right that it's, you know, I wish it were as simple as making it more tax efficient for businesses to hire an individual employee. I mean, I wish that were what were holding us back, you know, but I don't think it is. I don't think that's what it is. I think they simply don't see the demand. There's still enough slack in a lot of these markets. And unless you're kind of an export oriented company, you're just, you know, there's a long hangover from what we experienced a couple of years ago. So I don't think that I think that it is important that, you know, any president make gestures of trying to do something. I mean, in a democracy, it's just the nature of the beast. You can't just say it'll get better on its own, and then you're Herbert Hoover, right? So I don't think it's going to cause much harm in particular, with the exception of some of those maybe little pockets of little provisions. I mean, I know there's also something in there about, you know, obviously making municipal bonds a little bit less attractive for upper income folks, who are the folks who own municipal bonds,
right?
Almost exclusively. Who knows what the prospects of that getting through are. So, I think the mood is definitely pretty glum. Now, on some level, if the market hangs in there, I think, yeah, I just did see like professional newsletter writers or, you know, kind of similarly negative to what they were in, you know, sometime in 2009, not at the very bottom, but sometime in 2009. So I feel like the muscle memory of that crisis is still pretty much in force. What I mean by that is, while many people were blindsided back then, right now, not only are we not blindsided, we're sort of seeing the potential rerun of 08 in almost everything going on right now. So you're kind of braced for it a little more. And to me, that insulates us to some degree on downside. But, you know, I'm not that confident that we can sort of say, hey, everybody's bearish, it's time to be bullish.
Right. You know, the other thing is I'll mention, and I don't know if I've explored this with you, but I've written about this over the last 2.5 years, is that the structural problems with the unemployment situation are much greater than just the idea that there's a lot of confusion and concern out there. I do believe that, and it's only been written about that I saw recently, very recently by somebody, is that the technology that we have and the robotics slash efficiency that we've created over the last several years, there is no reason, there is no need for a file clerk anymore. That entire level of personnel has been obliterated. You know, where you used to write your newspaper one way, you used to write your columns maybe one way and submit them another way. Forget about it. I mean, there's like five people that probably aren't even needed anymore to do what you did.
Right. And so, that explains the paradox of, you know, companies having so much cash and being so profitable and not doing a lot of hiring.
Right.
Because they have invested to some degree, but they've invested in labor-saving technology.
Exactly.
This whole period. And you know, that's obviously been going on a long time. We actually wrote a cover story out of the late 90s called The Disappearing Secretary.
Right. Right, perfect.
Which basically meant an entire generation of executives, they didn't want a secretary. You know, I mean, yeah, you'd have a shared assistant or something. But, and you know, even if you did have an assistant, you wanted that person to be somebody who had the ability to be redeployed in a higher role down the road, right? You don't want to just hire a career secretary. My wife is exactly in this case. She's done it multiple times. Now, that's happened across a bunch of different job categories, and it's been going on for whatever it is, 15 years. I think what kind of obscured it a few years ago, and when the jobs numbers were good, is that you had the housing boom, and you had 700,000 more people working as roofers and contractors than you do right now. Probably more than that. And so, you know, you had this ability for people who, you know, didn't really have kind of an obvious place in sort of the high tech, you know, white collar world, who had good paying options.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten rid of a lot of those just because of what happened cyclically in the housing market. And then that's brought to light the fact that structurally, you know, companies are just geared not to need as many people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need a secretary per se anymore. I mean, you have a computer that does it. We all start typing faster. There's all these correction devices, and everything goes through email. And people are in business; they're more forgiving of the
language. You don't need somebody answering your phone.
Yeah,
or, you know,
you don't need any of that stuff really anymore. The stuff that you did, or at least the switchboard. You know, the old days, the switchboard, all that. So anyway, lots going on. Listen, I'm sure you have lots to write about, and everybody should make sure to pick up their copy of Barron's, of course, and not only the weekend edition, but on the blog, on the daily website. There's also a lot of things that Mike writes, and usually either a cover story or some of the. You do one of the free things. Almost yours is free on the website weekly, usually, right?
I think it varies, but it often is free, and you know, you can kind of get around, get in through the back door sometimes. Yeah.
Yep, I understand that. All right, Mike Santoli, Barron's. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.
Buddy. Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, we're going to wrap it up here, and I want to thank you for joining in today. We have Larry Williams coming up, and that's going to be, I believe, in a week or so. I spent some time with Guy Adami up in New York just a few minutes when I was passing by on my way out, and we're going to have him on again shortly, as well as made friends with Anthony Scaramucci and also Joe Terranova. We're going to have all these guys on very shortly from the CNBC Fast Money Group, find out what they're doing and how fast their money is right now and what they're doing. And then on top of that, we're going to also have a lot of fun when it comes to next month with our Stocktoberfest. So make sure you do that. Follow Andrew Horowitz at Andrew Horowitz. Pick up The Disciplined Investor over at Amazon or The Winning Investor. And make sure to listen in to DH Unplugged every week. That's a lot of fun. We have a lot of questions that came in we'll also answer. And we have just a lot of, I think we're going to start hitting stride with some really great guests coming up. Got to get Ritholtz on. I kind of missed him over in the conference up in at Bloomberg. Make sure to go over to The Disciplined Investor this week and search for the Bloomberg 50. Just go into the search on the top over at disciplinedinvestor.com and search for that. And if you're interested, if you're wondering what to do with your money at this point, well, we have an idea. We can go long, short. We can hedge. We can do some arbitrage. All sorts of little things that you may not be able to or want to do over the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. There is a virtual tour available on the site. If you've been hesitant, you've been thinking about, should I stay in this mutual fund? Do I want to just be a buy and hold? I can't take it anymore. That's where we come in. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, over to the little button that says, little blue button, little blue square that says, check out the virtual tour, hedge fund without a hedge fund concept, where you get the transparency and you understand what's going on. It's all in your account, your name, $50,000 minimum for that particular strategy. And we will get you going, get you everything you need and all the different information so you can understand what's happening. Until next week, thanks you for joining me. And be careful out there, because I do believe we are in for a little bit more of a rocky road right here. Don't expect everything to go straight up here. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. I'll see you soon. Have a very profitable week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.